This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds.
And today we are speaking with Robert Fabry, the author of the best-selling Vespasian series. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you for asking me, Anya. Pleasure to be here.
Now, you have been writing historical fiction about Roman history, and in particular about Vespasian, the Roman emperor. Why this specific Roman emperor, and sort of what time period of his life do you cover?
Well, Vespasian, for me, was a very, very simple choice. He was born in the time of Augustus, and he basically survives every Roman emperor up until the year of the four emperors in 69, and then he comes out on top and remains emperor for almost 10 years. The best thing about Vespasian is that he served in so many parts of the empire. So he was in Thrace, probably not at the time of the Thracian revolt, probably arrived just afterward, but I know it's no fun just arriving just after a revolt, so I fit him in towards the end. He was in Africa. He was in Germania. He was in Britannia. He was basically in Judea. He was all over the Roman Empire, with the exception of Hispania. And that was throughout his life. So I realized if I took Vespasian, then the backdrop of each book would be different. It's not just always going to be Rome and, you know, a province. It's going to be Rome and different provinces all the time. So you can meet different peoples, different situations, and explore the history of Rome in the first century through somebody who was actually present at quite a lot of the great events. And yes, to answer your second question, I take him from birth to death.
You go the whole of his life, because I guess, unlike a lot of emperors, had a bit of a different background, wealth, social, economically speaking.
Yeah, I mean, he was a new man. So he basically came from the Sabine Hills. He to the end of his life, he had a Sabine burr in his accent. You know, it's sort of, you know, like speaking strong Yorkshire all your life, even though you're in power. So he didn't care. He was proud of his accent. He was proud of his roots. I take him from his birth. At least not quite from his birth. That's not quite true. It's about 9 days after his birth. I take him from his naming ceremony, and then right through to his death. I skip, you know, bits and pieces, but basically, the main part of his life is covered.
So you must have had to do quite a bit of research, both with regards to his life, but also the context of where he was, the different parts in the empire, the other characters. I mean, what kind of work went into that?
Well, when I was small, I started collecting little lead soldiers. This is the long answer, by the way. I'll give you the short one if you wanted. I started collecting little lead soldiers, and I now have a collection of about just under 4,000 of them. Actually, here you go. Here's some of them. I don't know if you can see them.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. And there's tons more over there. Just keep on going around. You see, that's all. It's all lead soldiers. All hand painted. So, I used to refight battles with friends. So I've got Romans over there. Those are Seleucid. Got Thracians, Greeks, all sorts. So I used to refight battles. And you had to do that. You sort of read your Tacitus, or you read your whoever, and you know, set it up exactly how it was set up, and things like that. And we used to do this, you know, take a good long weekend, refight a night's battle, or just have a battle by ourselves. And when I got to about 45, and I'd been working in the film industry for the last 25 years, I asked myself, can I still be standing up and shouting at all these people all day to get them to do things when I'm 65? I thought, no, I can't. And I thought, well, what can I do? And I thought, well, I'm unemployable. So I've always liked reading historical fiction. So I thought, well, so I go at that. What do I know about? And I suddenly realised, with all this stuff that I've been doing, reading and stuff like that all my life, I knew more about the 1st century AD or the 3rd century BC, because Alexander and the successors were my other love, than most people. And it sort of came quite naturally. So I just started reading Tacitus properly. I started reading Suetonius properly. And I started reading history books around it, things like Invisible Romans to give me a view of the little people of society. Barbara Levitt's biography of Vespasian. And because I had already had a level of knowledge gathered completely by accident, it was became quite not straightforward, but I mean, it took a lot of work, but it was enjoyable work, and things just sort of fitted in position and into place. And I found myself really enjoying living back in the 1st century AD. I just moved back in time.
And I suppose you're based in Europe, so did you travel to some of the locations where these battles took place, or the
I've been to Rome many times. I've been to Thrace. I didn't go to Thrace for is now where they are is now in Bulgaria. I didn't go for there, but I do go around, especially when we're doing the invasion of Britannia, or when we're doing his time in Germania. When I'm in England, it's all there. It's all in Kent, and carrying on up the Thames and then down into the West Country. And here, when he's at what is now modern day Strasbourg, that's an hour and a half drive from where my parents-in-law live in the Saarland. So we go there, we go all around to places where he would have stood. And the other lovely thing about it is we have a flat in Battersea, just opposite Battersea Park. And one of the places that he may have crossed the Thames, although sort of between Albert Bridge and Battersea Bridge. And I walk over to the King's, when I'm in London, I walk over to the King's Road every day, go and do the shopping at Waitrose. That's how interesting I am. I just look at the Thames and think, God, the station was there. Yeah, isn't that great?
It must be different to be a historical fiction writer than, say, an academic, because I would say in our listeners, in our crowd, we sort of span the two easily. We've got students, we've got amateur academics, and we have people who just have the passion and interest in the classics. Do you think you experienced the history different by coming at it from a sort of a historical fiction writer rather than an academic standpoint?
Yes, because with an academic, I think the whole point is to find the truth, to find the solid historical facts argued and things, which is always very difficult. I did history, medieval history for A level, and so you're writing your essays, and he did this because of that, but this happened because of that, and it's just finding some sort of truth that you think that you can present to everyone and say, this is how it happened. Well, with writing historical fiction, the main two words there are historical and fiction. So you automatically have license. I take what are the perceived historical facts, which again may not be. I mean, for example, I mean, Suetonius wrote his histories of the Caesars, and it could actually, it is argued that it's a massive bit of propaganda, sort of dissing, you know, Nero, Claudius, and Caligula, and just to make Vespasian and Domitian, the new dynasty look good. So who knows? But I take those them as the historical facts, and then I weave my tale between them, and so that it's like, I always say, it's like joining the dots writing. You know where you start, you know where you want to end, you know a couple of places in the middle, and you've got to make a good story, you know, rollicking good, sword and sandals, within the terms of the history that we know and understand. So you're not writing a fantasy Rome, you're writing real Rome. This is Rome, how it was, how you see it, making it as entertaining as possible, as thrilling as possible, with everything that's going on, all the machinations of, you know, whether it be Claudius's freedmen, Narcissus and Pallas and Callistus, or you know, whether it be Vespasian's family with his brother, we know certain things about, his uncle that we know certain things about, his mistress Caenis or his wife Flavia, making it all work within the terms of everything that we know, and yet the whole thing's fiction, because who knows actually how Vespasian's life went. And I just come up with good reasons why he did such and such a thing, or why he was there. So the answer is, the short answer is yes, I have far more license. I could never write history. I'd probably end up making it all up, because my imagination is just, it's too wild to be an historian.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, Thucydides wrote as historically accurate as he felt, but he relays speeches and conversations that obviously he was not really privy to. What's the difference in way when you think about it? Because he's trying to fill out those gaps and find the motivations, and maybe takes a little bit of what he's heard here or there. But, you know, Pericles' speech is not Pericles' speech.
No. I mean, that was the convention of the time. Tacitus does exactly the same thing. I mean, he hasn't got a clue what certain people said at a certain time, but he knows roughly what they were trying to say. And he'd say, he writes a nice, big, long, flowery speech, and it's all very good. And everyone understands, at the time, they would have understood that is not actually what was said, but that was the essence of what was said, and a nice way of presenting it. And bravo, Tacitus. Very, very good, very good.
I guess for me, the difficulty would be trying to understand the motivations within the ancient Roman context, because I think some of the actions may not be as relatable to us today, because we sort of have our modern mindset and social expectations and things. And, you know, I was talking to a fellow the other day about, you know, the wrath of Achilles, for instance, and he's like, why is he so angry? And you're like, well, if you think about it in the ancient Greek mindset, he's probably not actually that angry, you know, compared to, say, obviously Hector was less angry, but Ajax was a lot more angry, you know. My point is that from our mindset, we're like, whoa, that's an insane thing to do. But maybe in the ancient world that made a lot more sense. So for you, do you have to try to go into the motivations of the ancient Romans, or do you try to think of the motivations that would make sense to your readers?
No, I mean, I try and dispense with all Judeo-Christian morality, and try and put myself back in the most competitive society of that was ancient Rome. I've got no interest in making my characters unrealistically modern. Vespasian is out for himself. Yes, he does have the odd bit of empathy here and there, and he's got people around him who have even less, if anything, no empathy. They are Romans. They are family orientated. They are there for survival. There's no such thing as welfare in those days. You know, you either claw yourself to the top or you die trying, or you end up dying in a gutter. Especially for that class, the Equites. I mean, your money could be lost at any time. No such thing as insurance, nothing. It's bloody, bloody hard living and surviving in those terms. It's even harder if you're part of the headcount. Which is why I actually have Vespasian's great mate Magnus, who's the leader of the South Quirinal Crossroads Brotherhood, as a foil. So with Magnus, I can actually look down and see what it's like, really, even further beneath Vespasian, places where Vespasian would not go. I do those in the Magnus short stories. A hard cover of which is going to be out in November. All six Magnus short stories, if you're interested. sorry, just get that one in. Anyway, Vespasian is as real a Roman as I can make him. And I dare to make him, I hope, towards the end. And this sounds a bit awful for me to say it. I hope he comes across in modern terms as really quite disagreeable. You know, and if I've done that, then I've done my job properly. Because if we were to meet your average Roman today, you would hate him. You would hate his attitudes. You would hate, you know, the way he thought and things like that. And so, you know, when I sometimes I despair when I read some, you know, Roman fiction or Greek. And you've got these very sounding modern characters who actually care about, you know, people and, you know, someone who actually, I mean, it's just wrong. I got a review now. Can you believe this? This was actually by a no names, no patrol, but another Roman author. And it was reviewing my first Magnus short story. And he said, I very enjoyed it, but I can't just give this a good review because I don't believe in stories where the villain goes unpunished. I'm sorry. That happens all the bloody time, especially in Rome, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the historical part, you know.
That's the story, you know. Oh, come on, lighten up, you know. So, you know, throw off those Judeo-Christian Western shackles and just enjoy yourself back in Rome.
So why should the reader care about your emperor then if he's not a likable guy? Like, what drives them to want to learn more about him?
In Roman terms, he is. You see, I mean, the characters that he's up against, I mean, yeah, he's got to deal with Caligula. I mean, you know, that's hard work in itself. Although I paint a slightly more sympathetic version of Caligula in that I have a lot of his motivation is due to the Senate's tacit compliance with the extermination of almost his entire family, which is what I have him doing is punishing the Senate in return. He's not necessarily mad. This is just a long-term revenge which he embarks upon. And yes, he does go a bit too far. Then you have Claudius's freedmen who are completely out for themselves. You know, Vespasian somehow maneuvers his way around it and, you know, comes out looking much better than they do. But it's all relative. It's all relative. I mean, personally, I find him a very likable person, but perhaps I've been living in first century Rome slightly too long.
So in your research, was there something that really shocked you or surprised you about the time period or about any of your characters that you were like, wow, I didn't know that at all?
Well, most of it you just can't make up. you know, it's you just can't make it up. I mean, after a very short time, I ceased being surprised, about what was going on, why, and oh, I don't know. What is shocking? What did shock me? God. I mean, I quite like the old Caligula story of it was a circus purpose built on the campus marshes, and anyway, the crowd were playing up, and they weren't behaving, and I think it was some issue about them not treating him with respect to the god, and he just goes, "You see that bald head to that bald head, throw him in." The Praetorium going around there, all these free people, you know, freeborn or freed people, and just chucked them into the arena, and let the lions in. I mean, that's how arbitrary life is, you know, in those days. Yeah, I mean, when you know, you're not really shocked by that, but when you actually think, oh my God, you know, even for a Roman, that is pretty, pretty shocking.
Yeah, I guess it gives you a bit of perspective on your own life at times. The that we have, you know, we're like stressing out because we're going to be late to a meeting, but like, hey, we're not going to be thrown into the lions.
We're not going to be thrown into the lions. No, yeah.
Okay, so I guess the next question is, historical fiction writers just have so much power over how their characters are determined and whether you like them or not. And I would say probably the most arguably famous is Robert Graves's I, Claudius, that, you know, here was an emperor that nobody really cared that much about. And then afterwards, he kind of was given a new happy light.
He was fictionalized. Yeah.
But like, for instance, we have a Classical Wisdom magazine, and we did a whole issue sort of dedicated to the Julian Claudian dynasty. And in it, we have a whole article about Grapina, how maybe she was sort of unjustly written as this sort of incestuous, poisoning, you know, malicious character. But that, you know, in that time period, it was very easy to say somebody was a poisoner or incestual without having any proof, and that it was a common political tactic to defame somebody if you wanted to. And that if you look at some of the records, that, you know, there were actually less assassinations during the time period when she was exerting control over Claudius, and that he actually was maybe a bit more violent when she wasn't around.
He executed more of the upper classes than Caligula did.
Yeah, so you, I mean, you have quite a lot of power. How do you sort of choose how to denote people? And I guess also by extension, how do you feel about Claudius and Agrippina?
Well, I mean, Roman terms, Agrippina was incestuous, in that she was Claudius's niece, and it was not really done to marry your niece. That was seen as incest. So that really isn't an accusation that can be refuted. As to her, I mean, she, again, had most of her siblings killed. She was a survivor. She had a son, Nero. She married her uncle for one reason alone, to secure her and her son's future. There was, of course, somebody in the way, Britannicus, Claudius's own natural son, his end came fairly soon after Claudius's. Claudius, whether he was poisoned with mushrooms or whatever, or with the feather from the doctor as he tried to get the first lot of mushrooms out, which the poison hadn't completely worked. I don't know. I mean, where I stand with all that is that's how it's reported. I would say that in terms of Agrippina, she is a pretty much straightforward, high-class woman in Roman terms. We find her unacceptable because of our moral baggage. Romans found her very difficult to deal with because she was a very powerful woman, personality-wise. Not that they minded that so much, but that what they did mind was when a powerful woman tried to inveigle her way into what was seen as being a male preserve, i.e. the governance of the empire. Fine to do it from behind the scenes, but actually to start sitting yourself, wanting to sit yourself on the dais next to the emperor and doing all that sort of thing was seen as a bit too much. I think basically we're we come from Messalina to Agrippina, and we have a series of disastrous wives for Claudius, who I can never quite understand how Robert Grace does his sort of bumbling old man thing, which is. Which is fine, because he was an intellectual. He was a pedant as well. He wanted to put three new letters of the alphabet in. He wrote his history of the Etruscans. He did all sorts of very good things. He also laughed at his own jokes a lot. He was inordinately excited with the sight of blood. He wasn't. Robert Graves portrays a half of him. I think. In the valued half, but I never quite understand why he doesn't do the other bit, which would explain much more how Agrippina could have such a hold on him, because they would both feed off each other's viciousness, whereas in the Robert Gray's version, you just don't understand how Claudius puts up with this. I'm on the side of Agrippina being really rather a vicious person, and I think it's borne out. I don't think it's just propaganda from Suetonius.
So, following that, then how did you sort of decide how to portray Vespasian?
Vespasian, I took him as a very straightforward man of the land, farming person, who has no wish to go to Rome, and then when he sees Rome for the first time, is completely seduced by her and the idea of it. And then as he learns about how the Republic morphed into the Empire and how the rights of people, the men who used to serve in the army, because they had a stake in the Republic, because they had land in the Republic, and they needed to protect that land. And as the army then fought for further and further, farther and farther afield, and they were away for longer, and they came back, and the farms were overgrown, they were pushed off, and then the big landowners started to buy up all these lands, and you had then these men would move to Rome. They'd have nothing there, and then Marius introduced the army, the professional army in 105 BC, and then you'd serve for 25 years, and then so the grandchildren of the people who used to fight for the Republic because they had a stake in it now fought for what was coming into civil war, and then starting to fight for the generals. In order to get their stake back. And Vespasian sees that, and he understands that he's got to try and keep, he believes that he needs to fight for that Rome, to keep Rome still progressing. He loves the idea of Rome. And yes, we have the empire. Yes, the republic is a forgotten thing. But he sort of looks back on it and thinks, well, that was quite good, and what we're doing now isn't so good. Yet he has to work within Caligula's law, well, of Tiberius first and Caligula. And he understands how the whole thing works, and he becomes very, very good at politics because he's a sensible, straightforward man who understands land administration from a very early age, and he puts that into the way he manages to navigate his way through the empire. So he has a great sense of humour, which I try and bring out all the time, and as I said, practical sense and a sense of history. So those are the three main ingredients I decided to put into him.
And do you think modern readers draw parallels to modern situations? Or is that not to be said?
The thing about history is, I always find it, you can keep on saying, oh, it was ever thus. things always happen. repeat, it's a, I mean, it's like in the Magnus short stories, there's six of them, and, one of them is about child trafficking. Another one is about fixing horse races or chariot races. Another one, Magnus goes into property development at one point. He goes into arms smuggling. Stuff that's always around. So I always do. I do the ancient Roman equivalent of modern stories. Yes, I mean, and I often find myself. Saying something that is, I mean, like just recently, I found myself saying having a character say, yes, but we'll tell the people this. It's always useful to have alternative facts. Trump's hideous witch, whatever. That's been going on since we could all reason.
I guess sometimes you look at modern situations, you think maybe it's best just to live in the first world AD.
The only difference is we've got the internet and cars. Combustion engines.
So to finish up a bit, can you let everyone know what you're working on at the moment?
The last dissertation came out January, and as I said, the collected Magnus short stories, which I wrote, which punctuate the whole series and connect up bits and pieces, that comes out in November. And then my new series, first one of which comes out in January, is called Alexander's Legacy. And the first one, To the Strongest, what else could it be called, comes out, as I say, January. Then I've just finished, I finished the second one, which is called The Three Paradises. And I'm about two-thirds of the way through the third. And basically, it's the story of Alexander's successors. So we start off the first chapter. You just see the ring shaking. Like that. It's Alexander's ring, the great ring of Macedon, with the 16-point sunblaze, starblazing of Macedon. And there it is. And he says, to the strongest, and neglects to say who that is. And with those three words, the world plunges in. And there you go.
Wow, that sounds very exciting.
Yeah, I'm probably going to take it all the way to Pyrrhus, so 50 years. But whether I divide the series into two series, so basically have the first series, which will be until the last man standing around Alexander, the last one of his seven bodyguards dies, and then take a new series on to the next generation, or whether I go all the way through, I don't know. All I know is that it's It's a fantastic seam of history, which is pretty much undisturbed by historical fiction writers. Mary Renault did one book, Funeral Games, sort of deals with the whole thing, which I'm going to do in 9 or 10. And again, you can't make it up. You got 300 men mutineers being tied up and thrown to the ground in front of the army, and Perdiccas drives his elephants over them. You know, it's lovely stuff. you got Roxana, one of Alexander's widows, poisoning the other two widows and throwing their bodies down a well. And it's just superb. It really is. You know, and Perdiccas's army sort of gets swamped by the Nile, and you know, God knows how, and gets eaten by crocodiles. I don't have to do anything.
Excellent fodder. Okay, well, I'll finish up there today then and say thank you, Robert, so much for talking to us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Anya.
I'll put some links below for any listeners that want to check out your books and the Vestation series, as well as any upcoming things. And yes, thank you again.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.